what is sort of industry like thinking for you and what is sort of academic like thinking for you?
Well, one big difference I found between my work in work and in the university. So in the university, when I come up with an algorithm, if I cannot come up with firm performance guarantees, I'm not going to do anything. If I cannot prove anything about it, I leave it. Of course, in the industry world, you run it. You see, does it work well on your real data? Okay, great. Even if I cannot prove, I still like this algorithm. Intuition has a big role in academic research, has a probably bigger role in industrial research.
Hello, Omri and Or, and hello, Lena. Welcome to another Macademia episode.
Hello.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So it is the first for us interviewing two people. Right, Lena?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. And it's a highly interesting topic. So I immerse myself through the day in what is Weka. And I'm very interested to hear what you're doing and how you integrating academic work and entrepreneurship and making internet better. So let's start by introducing you guys. Go on.
So thanks a lot for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be here. My name is Omri Pelmon. I'm coming from a technical and academic background. I did my bachelor and master degree in math and then Tel Aviv University, and then a PhD in computer science at Stanford at really a bit long time ago, 92 to 96. I've also been like programming computers since... really, like I actually programmed on punch cards, as strange as it sounds. Somehow with time, my PhD was kind of like my last touch point with academic careers. And after changing to like technical R&D positions, I also switched to the dark side of the PowerPoint, and I'm doing like more management, and I did product management positions, etc. And right now, I'm one of the founders of Weka, a startup in storage. Storage is the big infrastructure that stores your data. We're kind of the big organization Dropbox, but really, really big organization Dropbox. Like if you think about genomic sequencing of 5 million people, like you have the more information that Dropbox has, more or less. And you need to serve a lot of people with high performance. And we're doing, this is a huge industry. Unlike other startups, Weka is not coming with a vision of some new market. We're actually taking an existing market and say, guys, we're doing it better. And we're, just to give you order of magnitude, we're roughly 160 people with somewhere around 70 to 80 customers, like major brand names with very revolutionary products.
I think the first thing I'd love to hear is what is Weka? What does it mean?
Sure. So, okay. Please.
Yeah, so I'll keep you in suspense about what is Weka. But in the meantime, I'll tell a little bit about myself. So I'm Or Oldenflich. I'm an associate professor in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in the School of Computer Science and Engineering. And I am an algorithms architect at Weka. I've done all my my degrees in Tel Aviv University in electrical engineering. And then when I finished that, I went to a postdoc in MIT for 2 years. It was between 2015 and 2017. And yeah, I've been in the Hebrew University for about 4 years now, having a lot of fun, both in the Hebrew University and in Weka. And my field of research is information theory. So information theory is basically the mathematical foundations of the information era, of digital communication, compression, etc. Everything we're doing in this Zoom conversation is really based on the principles laid by Shannon in 48. This is the father of information theory and the information age. And what my research is about is really about understanding the fundamental limits of various communication setups or inference setups. the idea is really assume you had a supercomputer that has no computational limits. Now, what is the best performance you can achieve given your physical limitations? For example, if you have some optical fiber, the physics limit how many bits you can send over this fiber for, say, 1 second of communication. Information theory aims to understand this limitation. And then afterwards, comes the communication engineers and try to approach these limits with practical systems. Of course, we don't have supercomputers. So, we also need efficient algorithms that approach these limits. But the first questions I try to answer for a given model, what is the best you could do if you had no computational limits? And then after I understand these fundamental limits, I start thinking about, okay, so now how can you do this efficiently? Once you've understood, where the limitations come from, it's much easier to design the algorithms that approach these limits under your computational barriers.
So is it just theoretical thinking, or you can do an experiment to test your...
No, the most experimental things I do is sort of MATLAB or Python experiments. Mm-hmm. So simulations is the most experimental thing I get to. And I usually in my research, I try not to get there. So a good paper for me is a paper where I proved a theorem stating that this is the best you can do. So it usually involves showing you cannot do better than some bound you have found and the matching algorithm that achieves this bound. But these algorithms in the paper are usually not efficient, so no computer can run them. Mm. And then the next paper is, how do I design an efficient algorithm that approaches this bound? And once you come up with an algorithm, usually the best thing you could do is prove that it achieves a certain performance. If I can do this, I'm very happy. But usually... you prove some performance guarantees for the algorithm under some assumptions, and you run the algorithm under more realistic assumptions for which you cannot prove anything, and try to verify that it's working as well as you expected.
It's interesting. It sounds a lot like we do in biology when we have a normally function like tissue, and we understand the components that leads to a normal function. This is our limitation, or the optimal performance. And then disease coming, just in order to understand what happens in disease and how we can interfere with that. So we infer from the optimal function and then understand what components are gone wrong and how we can tweak them back to optimal performance. Now, being done with gene editing or all kind of tools. But it's interesting because it's also an engineering problem, like the cell, but it's like slightly different language. But the idea, I think to me, the idea looks the same.
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
So totally leaving unrelated, but interesting. Not to people know that actually math in the 19th century and before was kind of physics. People experimented and find out what is the truth. And the idea that math is about proving things and axiom and theorems and proofs, that's relatively new. That's end of 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And I think computer science kind of took this round up that the computer started from mathematical background, but is really about the real world. And you see a lot of things in computer science, what we actually can do it and we don't know why, like the simplex algorithm. So totally distracting the topic, and feel free to edit us out.
No, it's interesting. Thank you. So I wonder, so it sounds very, without knowing what Weka does, what you do or sounds applicative from the very start, right? Like so when you started your research or when you got into thinking about these topics, were you thinking about what kind of implication in the real world this might have?
Oh, yeah, always. I mean, my research, I do I do sin sometimes in doing very non-applicative research in pure math, etc. But most of my research is motivated by really practical applications. So I always think, what can I contribute to this particular model that is used in the real world? But usually I try to, I try to come up with the next paradigm, you know, how would system look like 10 years from now? Mm-hmm. Like, if you were building a new network, and you did not have to worry about the compatibility and stuff like this, how would you design the best scheme to solve? One good example is for a problem I've been working on not too many years ago is IoT. Internet of Things. So this is a new communication model where you have a lot of devices that try to communicate at the same time, simultaneously, but they have very little information to send. Right? So you're thinking about sensors for agricultural applications. So all they have to do is send a short message every time the soil is too humid or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's very small messages. It's not streaming Netflix videos, but they all have to transmit together. And the real constraint is energy, because once the batteries of the sensors run out, no one comes and charges them. They just die. So this is a completely new model. And when we realized this model is interesting, we started envisioning how would you design the best communication schemes for this. Now, what the companies are doing today is very far from the solutions we came up with. Because today, IoT is not as big as it is projected to be in a few years. So they use some very inefficient schemes that work well as long as there is less than a million sensors in a given area. Mm-hmm. But once it grows bigger and they become, 1 billion sensors within the same area, these mm-hmm. schemes will collapse right now. So the industry is not that concerned about this problem at this particular point. But I mm-hmm. think our job as academics doing applicative research is to solve the problems of that will arise in a few years. So when they do arise, we already know what to do.
But to you, you solved it. Now it sort of it exists, and you move on, right?
Yes. Solved it is a big word, right? So I've published the first paper about this with my collaborator, my postdoc host in MIT, and there's been hundreds of follow-ups afterwards, and each one improves a little bit, right? So I solved it. It's still work in progress, that the community is still working on this, but we're in a much better situation today than where we were 4 years ago when we started looking into this model. And I think in a year or two where this model will become relevant, the companies will go to the papers and will know what to do.
I see. So Omri, you found OR in this way, right? You looked up something interesting and sort of you were looking for something that's relevant. Tell us about Weka so that we can think about this more.
So Weka, first you ask about the name.
Yes.
Weka is two meanings to it. Weka is actually a bit unofficial name to 10 to the power of 30. So the one after PETA, EXA, IOTA, ETA, sometimes like the next available domain was Weka. Mm-hmm. And Weka is also a bird from New Zealand. It's kind of like a bit one of these birds that don't fly. But when we set the name, it was too late. the name was already there. And because actually naming company after a bird that don't fly and that can be negative.
Don't tell anyone.
we were told at presentations, do you know that these birds just don't fly? And is that a good name? And we were kind of, full speed ahead with the name. So Weka is As I said, it's a startup in storage where we're developing the really next generation high performance storage. We are very much different from any other storage system in the sense that we can simply scale. When you scaling is the ability like to do more with more resources. So if you have to move the content of like an entire building of like 10 office of, I don't know, 10 floors, then you might solve that by ordering 30 trucks to come you and help 100 people, but you can still do it in one day. But if transferring shipping things from Tel Aviv to Haifa takes an hour, it's not that by using 1,000 trucks, you can get it in less time. So some problems in real life are what's called scalable, throw more resources on them and they're being solved easier and simpler. And sometimes you just, it doesn't help to have more resources, they're just a limit. And what we've created at Weka, which was very innovative, is that we make performance a truly scalable problem. So if you need now to train some, say, autonomous car, and you need to scan 10 petabytes of images within like 24 hours in order to do one more training session, then with standard systems, they would just tell you, okay, that's the best we can do. We can't do more than that. That's the physics. That's going from Tel Aviv to Haifa. While with Weka, customer is saying, I want to scan everything in one day. That's, you say, no problem. We can do it with that much hardware. And you want it to half a day, just double the amount of hardware. And it sounds trivial, but it's really not. It doesn't sound trivial. it's really rocket science. It sounds intuitive, not trivial. But it is truly like a rocket science technology, which Weka is, I think some systems solve that in some aspects, but Weka is the first to solve that in every aspect of performance.
So how did you identify the problem and how did you think about the solution?
So we were part of the group of XIV, which I don't know if people know. We were a storage startup founded in 2002, and then IBM acquired us 2008, stayed within IBM until 2011. And then we kind of looked on the next thing of what other problem need to be solved. And now going deep into the storage people, XIV was what's so-called the block solution, like a disk solution. And we noticed that the file storage industry has actually been very unable to make the next breakthrough. Actually, until today, the dominating technologies are still from the 90s, which is unheard of in the area of IT infrastructure. And we decided we should do the next generation file. That's the right time to do that.
So this is a place that, or a point of view of what is the limitation of a system comes into place and really points out if this is what they're doing,
Or is focused on one aspect of the system. Like when you're doing storage system, there's tons of various features. You need to store the data. You need to be able to make it resilient. You're also encrypting data, so you can safely like store medical information and be sure who's accessing that, or if someone get hold of the physical media, he cannot read your credit card details, etc. And part of it is purely like, I would say, engineering, making things work, but a lot of it is really algorithmical, truly like computer science, complicated math, and always helping us with these aspects.
Yeah, so I think, as I said, a lot of my time goes to proving what cannot be done and what is the best that can be done with algorithms you cannot implement. No one would in the industry would pay me to do that, right? You don't care what you cannot do. It's good to know what you cannot do so you will not waste your engineer's time on this, but you really want to get things done. So in Weka, I'm more under the hat of my second hat. Once you know what you want to do, how do you do it efficiently? So in Weka, as I said, I'm an algorithms architect. I'm not developing upper and lower bounds.
Listen, or if I can find a university professor that can sign a paper and saying, like in the field that I'm working on, this cannot be done. Oh my God, that would be amazing.
No, definitely. No. I want to make this point sharper. Of course, I truly believe there is great value for industry in understanding what can and cannot be done. But the industry usually would not pay you to develop these bounds on their own expense. Usually, this is what you do with your academic grants. There's a famous story about some mathematicians that worked in a big company, and I would not say names, but all this guy ever did was prove impossibility results. And then they asked him, okay, how do you make them pay you for proving impossibility results? And the response was, this is how they convince customers they need to buy more hardware. So, you know, there is some value for companies improving impossibility results, but usually in our academic hats, in our industrial hats, we try to make things work rather than prove what cannot be done.
Do you find it sort of, it's just interesting to, because it's so clear sort of what is sort of industry like thinking for you and what is sort of academic like thinking for you. Do you find yourself sort of actively switching from one to the other or I don't know.
Yeah, so I think academic thinking is already hardwired in my brain, so I cannot... I cannot completely switch to industrial thinking, and I don't think I should. I mean, it's good when I'm trying to solve a problem. I still like to first spend some time thinking about the problem in more abstract terms. It helps mm-hmm. to come up with the solution. But I think one big difference I found between my work in Weka and in the university. So in the university, when I come up with an algorithm, if I cannot come up with firm performance guarantees, I'm not going to do anything with it. You know, if I cannot prove anything about it, I leave it. And of course, in the industry world, you run it and you see, does it work well on your real data? Okay, great. Even if I cannot prove, I still like this algorithm, and I still want to have some intuition to why it works, because maybe tomorrow I will run it on a new set of data and it will work terrible. So you still need to sort of understand why it's working. But you know, once I develop this intuition, then and I see that my intuition is correct, I don't bother proving anything about it. So this is a very different. I think it's more intuition has a big role in academic research, but it has a probably bigger role in industrial research.
I do want to say here that we're talking about academia, and I think the last sentences were really, I should have switched academic to science, because if you look on the engineering part of academia, they're totally just about making things work. They couldn't care less. And I think what's really interesting parts about computer science is that in different universities, computer science is either under science, math, etc., or sometimes in other under engineering. And for example, the computer science department at Stanford actually moved from the sciences to the engineering at a certain point. And there's quite a lot of real life projects, like RISC architecture, famous academic project turned into real life. VMware, the large one of the revolutionaries in IT infrastructure, started as a research project at Stanford. And so really, and I think anyone who actually mm-hmm. lives in academic life in the US is much more conscious about that. Even within the academy, the engineering part is actually trying to do things while the science part try to to know more.
Yeah. So on that, I want to ask you, Omri, you've ran product, you ran projects, you now run like a whole company. So what is the added value of mixing a team of highly experienced product people, engineering coming from industry or growing, but from the bottom up within industry with the scientific or academic knowledge coming from outside, this mixed team? What is the added value of that?
I think it's not added value, it's value. There's certain things you just need the academic knowledge and the academic know-how. It's just there's at certain point there's just a limit to what engineers can do. And to be honest, I think every good computer programmer engineer should have mathematical background. I'm a bit biased by having one myself, but I really think that in order to write, I hate the word real software because it implies that some of my best friends do not write real software. But if you talk about really software that does what's so-called back-end interesting things, like stores data, computes things, understands artificial intelligence, etc., unlike just user interface, smartphone apps, etc., you need a lot of mathematical background to do it properly, both in terms of actually know-how and knowledge, and more important, that's way of thinking. So I don't think it's a value add that there is a company and then you are you're taking a research to do something a bit better. There's actually certain areas that you just need academic knowledge. Some of it is academic knowledge which is already in the public domain, like when we did what's so called clustering algorithms, that how do 100 computers agree on something and not keep disagreeing forever. We would just take reference articles and the academic work that was available in the open. We didn't need people from the academia. We needed to understand what they're doing. But when you're on the bleeding edge, what's so called, and you need to take the most, then you better actually take people from the academia that are actually currently researching the topic.
So when you described Weka, you said it's scalable, and this is one of the main features of this. And just for me, browsing on the website and possible solutions, it differs a lot. Mm-hmm. So you talk about autonomous vehicle and life science. This is different types of data. So I just imagine how you integrate imaging, clinical imaging, with genomic data, two very different types of data. Just combining them together or storage for each one is a challenge by itself. And you say Weka is scaling on both ends. And it's so how do you go about it? How do you, first of all, pick this area that needs solutions or better solutions in storage and go at it? And how do you scale the product to different type of data?
Wow. So these are very, very two different questions. So the first one, if I understand correctly, is about how do I find who needs, I'm doing a lot of performance. And to be honest, that's a difficult question for every startup, especially startups that were originated from technological people seeing a technological quantum leap. We can now do that. And then they're kind of looking for someone who needs that. Unlike other startups, I think more common in Silicon Valley, you say, okay, we understand now someone needs something, let's find an engineer to implement it. And that's a lot of thinking and a lot of trial and error, to be honest. There's no silver bullet here. You have to learn a lot of market segments. You have to understand them. You have to see where you're doing the, where you're giving most value. And this is especially difficult with existing markets like storage that are huge, like $70 billion market. So very, very easy to be tempted. Like, this is just 2 billion. This is just 1 billion market. Why don't we do this and this and that? And on the other hand, it is a market populated by giants that are already there for 20 years and have like the whole field covered and all the feature needed, et cetera. Regarding the different applications, they're not that much different. Same way that your iPhone run or Android, sorry if I categorized you, that the same piece of hardware is being used both for chess playing or Facebook or taking camera or taking pictures. There's a basic capability here, and we are the basic core of the product is not oriented towards a specific application.
So I wonder, when you started looking for applications for your Leap technology, what, like, one area that you thought initially would be approachable and you disqualified, if you can share?
I'll give an example for an area that we tried, we disqualified, and now we're back in the game. So there's a lot of work, there's a lot of storage needed for media entertainment. So movies, like, you know, everybody know everything is digital, everybody know, like, going from 4K to 8K creates a lot of, like, storage challenges. And at the first phases of Weka, we had quite a few attempts to meet these companies and then provide them a solution. And we find out the hard way that we're missing a lot of features, that we do not understand what they need exactly, that they have actually like kind of like good enough solution from others. So they're a bit not like you need a lot of you need a lot of motivation to put your storage on a startup. Think of the Dropbox metaphor. Would you put all your life, how much do you pay for the Dropbox grant versus like a new startup, 20% cost less than Dropbox? Would you just put all your personal documents there? You would think twice. You need a really good reason to do that. And at certain point, we actually took a step back and went to market segments like artificial intelligence, like bio-IT, where added value was immense and compensated for all like us being a bit like the new kid of the block. That's interesting because now we do provide solutions to the media entertainment industry. Like, it just took us a bit more time to become more mature, but that's an example of a market segment we tried and like to find that we need a bit more time to support them.
So do you find yourself sort of adjusting the product for each industry?
It's not so much adjusting the product. It is just that there's an unbelievable huge of requirements from any storage system. Mm-hmm. As I said, that's the downside of having a startup in a mature market. That, mm-hmm. on the other hand, it's a mature market. It's great, a lot of money. No need to prove to VCs that people need to store data. You just need to be better. But just need to be better is difficult. And so it's more a question of ordering our priorities, and that's an endless process. So just mm-hmm. to give you the parallel example, XIV was founded 2002. IBM acquired us on the last day of 2007. I would say something kind of like in between a technology and a fully productized product. we scaled to like 3,000 systems in field by 2010, but people at IBM continued to develop and add more features to the product until actually recently, where the product was defined end of life. So almost 20 years of development and adding features is standard practice in storage. It's not a surprise to anyone.
So, or do you, are there other academics in the company that you work with, or do you, work alone, or how does it work?
Well, I mean, you need to define academics. So Omri, as a PhD, and you know, I've read, I didn't know before I joined WECA, but actually I've read some of his papers, and you know, it's really deep mathematics. So yeah, there definitely are more academics. I work closely with another co-founder in the company who he did not choose an academic career, but he could very easily choose one if he wanted to. So I think our discussions are, I feel like I'm talking to another professor. So yeah, I don't feel alone, and I don't work alone. Everyone I've worked with in WECA was at least as good as the students or colleagues I work with in the Hebrew University, and sometimes better.
So this is a great point you just raised, because you have done your postdoc at MIT, which is known for its founding startup translational science, one of the best places in the world. Maybe second to the Bay Area, but I'm biased. So, and you chose an academic route. You're a professor at the Hebrew University and also working with WECA. Why are you not making this jump final? Like, why are you living at both ends?
Yeah, good question. So let me tell you how my story evolved, actually. So, you know, some kids, when they start their undergraduate studies, they know I want to be a professor. My father was a professor. I also want to be a professor. I was not one of those kids, although my father is a sort of a professor. But I just wanted to, you know, get the education I need in order to maybe build a startup or just develop some interesting technology in some company. And then I think in my second year, so I studied electrical engineering, and you know, many students during their undergrad studies start working in student positions in companies. So I started doing this in my second year, and it was a very good startup, and I was positioned in the algorithms team, which is very good for students. Usually, you know, you run some tests in the lab at the best, but you know, they let me work on algorithms, and it all seemed very exciting. But after a few months, or maybe close to it, I realized you know, that the work here is I don't think this is what I want to be doing for my entire life. It's not deep enough in a sense. So I decided, okay, I'm trying to let me try and pursue an academic career. And yes, I did PhD, postdoc, all of this, and I love academic life. It was a great choice for me. But at some point, you know, I felt like, okay, I'm solving all these problems that I decided are interesting and I want to solve. But you know, maybe I'm missing the point, right? Maybe what I think is important in my when I sit in my office in the university and I don't implement anything, is actually disconnected from the real world. So let's try to reconnect to industry and see what people are really interested in. Let's tackle some real problems, not the ones I decided. You know, okay, one thing we always do in theoretical, let's say, so in information theory, which is sort of the theory behind practical systems. So we abstract the models, we make them very simple. So you know, so you can come up with a closed form solution And so sometimes you lose a lot in this process. It's very good. I think this is the way academic research should work. You need to, you know, put away all disturbing little details so you can get the essence of the problem. But then you need to bring them back. And sometimes when you start bringing those components back into the picture, your solution is not good anymore. So, you know, yeah, so I wanted, you know, to work on real problems again. And what I discovered, so I had a pretty bad experience in the past. So I thought, okay, industry is not as interesting and deep as academic world, but here I'm having a picture. And so in WECA, my experience is much better. The problems are really challenging, really deep. It requires all the academic knowledge I've acquired and all my my creativity. So it's great. I don't think I would want to make a full transition because there are a lot of problems that I want to solve. And as I said, no one will pay me to solve. So I'm really enthusiastic on proving impossibility results. I think this is, in a lot of problems, this is where the really creative mathematical ideas come into the picture. And this kind of stuff you usually can only do in academia. So I do not want to give it up. And so this is one aspect I do not want to give up. Another aspect is I really like deciding what I want to work on most of my time. So, okay, I don't need to do it 100% of my time. And work I'm solving the problem the company needs, not what I decided that I want to solve. But still, a lot of my time goes to tackling what I want to do now. And it's like this is a very, there are a few jobs that can compete with this benefit. You know, you do what you find interesting. Of course, you need to be very self-motivated for this. And it's not for everyone. You have to keep searching for the good problems and invest all the energies you have into solving them. But if you're someone that likes this kind of work, it's like you will not find it anywhere outside academia.
I wonder how does it work in your university? Because, for example, I remember when I was a postdoc, I signed an agreement that almost I think every thought that went through my mind belongs to Stanford. Did you sort of? Is it sort of? You have? How does it work?
Yes, so it used to be that way in the not so distant past, but I think universities, not just in Israel but across the world, have become much better in this. So universities realize that academic knowledge—it's good to have this fruitful relationship between academia and industry, and ideas need to pass. So. What you cannot do, I mean, I cannot take a technology I've developed in my in the Hebrew University, mm-hmm. and then and maybe patentized under the Hebrew University, and then use this particular technology in other companies. The university still wants and deserves the rights for the IP you have developed mm-hmm. under. As your work as a professor, but I think that the universities are supportive of letting the researchers go and devote some of their time in companies, and I think it's very beneficial for both sides. I mean, of course, for me, you know, I'm having fun thinking about other problems. But I think WECA also reflects on my academic research afterwards. And I get new ideas for new models that maybe I want to prove some bounds for. Maybe I want to abstract them a little bit and take a student to work on this. So, of course, I will not take a student to work on an algorithm I need for WECA. I need to do this separation. Mm-hmm. But ideas for theoretical questions that evolved while I worked in WECA. So these things happen all the time, and it helps keep the research connected to reality.
So Amrit, you did your PhD in 92 to 96 in Stanford. So just a few things that happened in this like area at that time. So they founded Yahoo, Netscape went into Nasdaq and started the dot-com bubble. Like small, you know, small startups started coming up in this area. So like in my mind, it really explained how you did a PhD in mathematics and in one of the best universities in the world, and not went into professorships and went into, you know, the like industry, or like you mentioned at the beginning, like the dark side, because you saw it. You saw people taking out stuff out of academia or taking out brilliant ideas and making millions of dollars of companies and making impact. Do you think we have, I'll start again, as a life science student myself in the Israeli academics, I think we were missing that. We're missing those models. We're missing that. We saw life from life science. We saw the high tech industry in Israel really building up, and then it became obvious that you do your bachelor's and maybe a master's in computer science and go work on huge problems and make profit to yourself, make big success outside of academia. Do you think that made a huge impact on you, and the high tech industry in Israel makes a huge impact on the computer science scholars in Israel?
So first of all, obviously yes. It's I think one of the culture shocks I had coming from Israel into US, that in Israel, especially at 92, universities were very academic, they were public. The idea that the university can actually get money from something was, I don't think anyone knew this language. And then I'm arriving to Stanford, and I think at Stanford at the time, there were anywhere between 10 and 15 professors that were post startup exit. And there was a very common theme that you work as a professor on a certain idea, you take a bunch of PhD students, and after a certain time in the academia, you actually form a startup, your PhD students become your first employees, and you just go ahead. And the university gets a kickback. So it's a win-win, and everybody's proud of. And at that time in Israel, it was, I don't want to say undignified, but I think all will agree that the old guard professors in the universities will see the chase after more money as not as respected as one more academic publishing or something like that. And I think the world has changed. Like, in the US, things has been accelerated, and even more and more, like the rate of like the of ideas flowing from universities to startups is much faster, and everybody encouraged that. And I think also in Israel, there is now a lot more openness and a lot more. If you look on Mobileye, if you look on others, still. Maybe work to be done, maybe things to be improved. I think Weizmann Institute is doing that in an amazing way. I think other universities are doing it better and better every year, and here all can respond. But I think, yes, we certainly there's more and more each year. I think there's faster exchange of ideas and intellectual properties and paradigms between the academic life and the startup.
Yeah, I think biotech is also follow.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Yeah, so I think to what we just said. So when you walk around my department, which is computer science and engineering, so really almost everyone is involved in some capacity in some company. So not, I wouldn't say there are so many founders and co-founders, but there are a lot of faculty members that are involved in the important scientific crossroads companies are facing. And yeah, as I said, I think it's a very good good thing, both for engineering and for science.
So both of you came back from the US, so Stanford, MIT. Do you think that this trip you took and came back brought this culture back? And all, for example, your cohort of professors coming back from a postdoc abroad brought this culture of like interplay between academia and industry. And we brought this entrepreneurship from basically the Garden of Eden of entrepreneurship into Israel. So you think this, the value of going abroad, coming back, has shaped the Israeli academic ecosystem, and we can go even larger, the entire ecosystem?
Well, I think you know, almost as you know very well, almost everyone that got an academic position needed to go abroad and have a postdoc in order to get this position. And I think it's very important that you do this, because okay, first you need to see how things are working in other places in the world, and also, of course, it's okay, you need to develop more, you know, new scientific skills that are different from what you did in your PhD. But besides of that, you also need to build your network of collaborators and people that know about your research. And that the best way to do this is going to a top university, where, you know, the one good thing about being in MIT, I'm sure also in Stanford, you don't need to work hard to get people to know about what you're doing, because all the experts are coming to you, right? Every week, some bigger name comes to MIT, and you meet them and you talk to them and exchange ideas, etc. And of course, it helps widen our small village into something that is better connected, and you get inspired from everyone. So it does, yeah, this epoch of, and this idea that everyone needs to go through a postdoc, it has a great influence on the Israeli academy, I think on every academy in the world. I don't know how it was for Omri. In my postdoc, I think that even though I was in MIT, where there are huge high-tech industry, I didn't feel that... there is that much of connection between the two. I think it was more like something some of the professors did in their own time. But when you're in campus, it felt like it's all about the research. Every once in a while, you know, someone from a company came and gave a talk about how they envisioned the future, and it's good to attend those talks, because it sort of gives you some ideas of. What problems you should focus on if you want to make an impact. But I didn't feel the presence of industry very strongly in there. I think it's different in Stanford.
Yeah, definitely. I think it also changes with time.
For a start, it is definitely different at Stanford. I think there's no question about that, and but I think that also all of these universities are so big that to a certain point, our own personal tendency to like scan a lot of events and choose them, they provide us an image of what is. So it might be that Stanford has, I don't know, 50% or 100% or 200% more industry interactions than MIT. I'm not sure what's the number, but believe me, you can live in Stanford like a lifelong PhD and postdoc and be only in academic circles, or you can have industry interactions like four times a week. It's also a question of your choice. But I do think, and coming back to the original question, I think not speaking in cliches, but the world is really, really smaller. You don't need to bring today like the from the US to things. I think it is just enough for people to know that there are more options, and people in Israel just imitate what's or imitate is kind of a negative word. They repeat and learn from things being done in the US, even without the need to actually travel today.
Yeah, I think I didn't check the numbers, but I think in Stanford, one of their main problems is people drop out and don't finish their undergrad or PhDs because they're taken up into the industry. So I think it's very present.
That's also true. I do know that my thesis advisor was actually did his PhD at MIT and tenure track at Stanford. And his point of view was like MIT, it's either like 2 feet of snow outside or 100 degrees and humid. So we just stayed all day and worked in the lab. Well, my students, they go hiking, they're biking, they go skiing in Tahoe. So no wonder MIT, everyone finished their PhD in 4 years, while median at Stanford is 7.
Yeah.
So one more point of view.
Great. So I think just before we wrap up, what is next for you guys and what is next for Weka?
Wow. What is next for Weka is to become a dominating entity in the world of storing data, of bringing new capabilities and making them available to as many customers, as many organizations as possible. What's next to us? I would say something that I hope would not be kind of trying to evade the question, but I find out that I constantly, in real life, I'm totally not aligned with my plans. So I had several plans several times and things happened totally different. So I kind of stopped making plans. So I don't know. Maybe I'll go back. I think if academia would accept people over 50, I might have made an application. But I think that route is closed for me. Though I do want to say that as a sidekick, that for example, in 2004, I taught 1 year at Haifa University just for the fun. So
yeah.
Maybe I'm sure. And that was totally unplanned.
You're always invited to do a postdoc with me.
If so, we do another interview on Omri being a postdoc at university. And then, what is a big limitation or problem you want to approach next?
Well, yes, so... I mean, for me, the plans for the future are easier. You know, once you're tenured, you know where you're going to be until you retire, more or less. I have my office. I'm probably going to be sitting there for another 30 years or so. And I have a long queue of problems I intend to solve by the time I retire. Hopefully, this queue will be dynamic and there will be new problems added to it and some that... someone will solve before me, so they will become irrelevant. And I hope to keep, mixing the academic and industrial work at some capacities. I find it fun and important. So this is my plan, more or less, to keep doing the same thing for 30 more years. Hopefully the achievements will increase every year, but the big plan is that.
I hope so. We have we introduced recently a new recurring question to the podcast, and I wanted to ask you guys, what is the sort of biggest myth that you had about academia or industry, and that you found it to be completely wrong?
Okay, I can say something about how I envision the academic life as a professor and what's different about it. So you know, when you're in your PhD or your postdoc, you have nothing going on except the one or two problems you're trying to solve, or maybe for you, since you come from biology, the experiments you want to complete and learn the results. And I envisioned this is what I'll be doing until I retire. If I get an academic position, I'll be sitting with a paper and pencil and try to prove the theorem. And then when you come to the university, you find out there are so many other things you need to be doing on top of this. And so if the time I thought I will have for pure research is much shorter than what I imagined. But on the plus side, you get to work with brilliant students that advance the frontiers you were trying to advance by yourself before. So there is some. It's not all bad. you don't do all the research yourself as I was hoping to do, but. To do it with some very strong people that are helping you.
That's great. Emily?
So, I think in a very similar way, I did my bachelor and master degree in math, and only then switched to computer science. And to give the full disclosure, actually, this is the transition because the PhD in math was kind of like just above what I could have handled. I'm not ashamed of that. Like, really, really, like, I'm actually proud of doing a master degree in math. And at the time, computer science was a very young field. And I kind of switched to computer science in the sense of an easy way to do a PhD in the US. And I will say that in general, people who study math tend to think of everything else as a bit trivial. I do want to say, for example, that I was admitted to a PhD in computer science without having even a degree in computer science. That's also the universities that accepted me, like, kind of were consistent with that view. And I was kind of a bit unclear on it was a bit of like an attempt, let's register and see what it means, kind of. And I expected, actually, following the academic life in Israel, a very math-oriented computer science department, and I find one which is very engineering-oriented. And for me, it took me time to figure this out and to understand. I still remember lecturing in a conference about an algorithm, and someone from the audience actually asked me if I wrote the computer program and tested. And I was like, no, why do you need to do that, kind of? And it took me time to actually see the feedback that the practical works also contributes back to the theoretical foundation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a pleasure, really. Omri Or was the first time we interviewed two people, and we might have to do this like that from now on. Two point of views, same mission. That was highly interesting, a new subject for me as well. Thank you. Thank you for sharing and being really open and honest. And it's important to our listener to hear those point of views from where it matter most. And next interview is when Omri is starting his postdoc, right?
Well, if someone will admit me, we'll see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ofer and Lena. It was fun.
Thank you. Bye. Both.